SeaRealm Vault Podcast, episode number 301.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hey, SeaRealm Vault subscribers, KMO here, and I have my son visiting, and it is very hot, so the air conditioning is on. There's nothing I can do. It is just too hot to try to sit here and record without the AC, so I apologize for the noise. I hope it doesn't prove distracting. Oh, and Mocha, my cat, absolutely hates the sound of air conditioning or fans, so you might hear her crying as well. Again, if I were to wait till I had a quiet environment in which to record, you wouldn't get a podcast for a while. So, to get us started, I want to share with you just the entirety of a text of an article. It was in The Nation, and my friend Mark posted it to the Friends of the SeaRealm group on Facebook. The piece is called "This Political Theorist Predicted the Rise of Trumpism. His name was Hunter S. Thompson." In Hell's Angels, the gonzo journalist wrote about left-behind people motivated only by, quote, "an ethic of total retaliation," close quote. Sound familiar? This is by Susan McWilliams, and this was published on December 15th, 2016. So she will refer to the president-elect. He has been our president now for going on a year and a half. But the issues that she's talking about in this piece haven't changed in that time. These are long-term trends. These are forces that will be with us, that have been with us for decades, and probably will be with us for decades. In late March, Donald Trump opened a rally in Wisconsin by mocking the state's governor, Scott Walker, who had just endorsed his Republican opponent, Ted Cruz. "He came in on his Harley," Trump said of Walker. I will not attempt a Trump impersonation. "But he doesn't look like a motorcycle guy." "The motorcycle guys," he added, "like Trump." It has been 50 years since Hunter S. Thompson published the definitive book on motorcycle guys, Hell's Angels, the strange and terrible saga of the outlaw motorcycle gangs. It grew out of a piece first published in The Nation 1 year earlier. My grandfather, Carrie McWilliams, editor of the magazine from 1955 to 1975, commissioned the piece from Thompson. It was the gonzo journalist's first big break, and the beginning of a friendship between the two men that would last until my grandfather died in 1980. Because of that family connection, I had long known that Hell's Angels was a political book. Even so, I was surprised when I finally picked it up a few years ago by how prophetic Thompson is and how eerily he anticipates 21st century American politics. This year, when people asked me what I thought of the election, I kept telling them to read Hell's Angels. Most people read Hell's Angels for the lurid stories of sex and drugs, but that misses the point entirely. What's truly shocking about reading the book today is how well Thompson foresaw the retaliatory right-wing politics that now goes by the name of Trumpism. After following the motorcycle guys around for months, Thompson concluded that the most striking thing about them was not their hedonism, but their, quote, "ethic of total retaliation," close quote, against a technologically advanced and economically changing America, in which they felt they'd been counted out and left behind. Thompson saw the appeal of that retaliatory ethic. He claimed that a small part of every human being longs to burn it all down, especially when faced with the great and impersonal powers that seem hostile to your very existence. In the United States, a place of ever greater and more impersonal powers, the ethic of total retaliation is likely to catch on. What made that outcome almost certain, Thompson thought, was the obliviousness of Berkeley, California types who, from the safety of their cocktail parties, imagined that they understood and represented the downtrodden. The Berkeley types, Thompson thought, were not going to realize how presumptuous they had been until the downtrodden broke into one of their cocktail parties and embarked on a campaign of rape, pillage, and slaughter. For Thompson, the angels weren't important because they heralded a new movement of cultural hedonism, but because they were the advance guard of a new kind of right-wing politics. As Thompson presciently wrote in the Nation piece he later expanded on in Hell's Angels, that kind of politics is, quote, nearly impossible to deal with, close quote, using reason or empathy, or awareness-raising, or any of the favored tools of the left. Hell's Angels concludes, when the angels ally with the John Birch Society and write to President Lyndon Johnson to offer their services to fight communism, much to the befuddlement of the anti-Vietnam elites who assumed the angels were on the side of the counterculture. The angels and their retaliatory militarism were, Thompson warned, the harbingers of a darker time to come. That time has arrived. 50 years after Thompson published his book, a lot of Americans have come to feel like motorcycle guys. At a time when so many of us are trying to understand what happened in the election, there are few better resources than Hell's Angels. That's not because Thompson was the only American writer to warn coastal left-liberal elites about their disconnection from poor and working-class white voters. Plenty of people issued such warnings. Journalists like Thompson Edsel, who for decades has been documenting the rise of, quote, Red America, close quote. And scholars like Christopher Lash, who saw as early as the 1980s that the elite embrace of technological advancement and individual liberation looked like a revolt to the mass of Americans, most of whom had been on the losing end of enough innovations to be skeptical about the dogmas of progress. But though Thompson's depiction of an alienated, white, masculine working-class culture, one that is fundamentally misunderstood by intellectuals, is not the only one out there, it was the first. And in some ways, it is still the best psychological study of those Americans, often dismissed as white trash or deplorables. Thompson's angels were mostly working-class white men who felt, not incorrectly, that they had been relegated to the sewer of American society. Their unswerving loyalty to the nation, the angels had started as a World War II veterans group, had not paid them any rewards or won them any enduring public respect. The manual labor skills that they had learned and cultivated were in declining demand. Though most of them had made it through high school, they did not have the more advanced levels of training that might lead to economic or professional security. Their lack of education, Thompson wrote, rendered them completely useless in a highly technical economy. Looking at the American future, they saw no place for themselves in it. In other words, the angels felt like strangers in their own land, as Arlie Russell Hochschild put it in her recent book on Red State America. They were clunky and outclassed and scorned, just like the Harley-Davidsons they chose to drive. Harleys had been the kings of the American motorcycle market until the early 1960s, when European and Japanese imports came onto the scene. Those imports were sleeker, faster, more efficient, and cheaper. Almost overnight, Harleys went from being in high demand to being the least appealing, most underpowered, and hard-to-handle motorcycles out there. It's not hard to see why the angels insisted on Harleys and identified strongly with their bikes. Just as there was no rational way to defend Harleys against foreign-made choppers, the angels saw no rational grounds on which to defend their own skills or loyalties against the emerging New World Order of the late 20th century. Their skills were outdated, their knowledge was insubstantial, their powers were inferior. There was no rational way to argue that they were better workers or citizens than the competition. The competition was effectively over, and the angels had lost. The standards by which they had been built had been definitively eclipsed. We parents tell our children that when you know you've lost an argument or a race, the right thing to do is to be a good sport and to get 'em next time. But if there is no next time, or you know that every next time you are going to be in the loser's lane again, what's the use of being a good sport? It would make you look even more ignorant and more like a loser to pretend like you think you have a chance. The game has been rigged against you. Why not piss on the field before you storm off? Why not stick up your finger at the whole goddamn game? Therein lies the ethic of total retaliation. The angels, rather than gracefully accepting their place as losers in an increasingly technical, intellectual, global, inclusive, progressive American society, stuck up their fingers at the whole enterprise. If you can't win, you can at least scare the bejesus out of the guy wearing the medal. You might not beat him, but you can make him pay attention to you. You can haunt him, make him worry that you're going to steal into his daughter's bedroom in the darkest night and have your way with her. And that she might actually like it. It's not hard to see in the demographics, the words, and the behavior of the Trump supporters an ethic of total retaliation at work. These are men and women who defend their vote by saying things like, "I just wanted people to know that I'm here, that I count." These are men and women whose scorn of political correctness translates into, "You can't make me talk the way you want me to talk, even if that way of talking is nicer and smarter and better." These are men and women whose denials of climate change are gleeful denials of scientific expertise in a world where scientific experts have unquestioned intellectual respect and social status. These are men and women who seemed to applaud the incompetence of Trump's campaign because competence itself is associated with membership in the elite. Thompson would want us to see this. These are men and women who know that by all intellectual and economic standards, they cannot win the game. So whether it be out of self-protection or an overcompensation for their own profound sense of shame, they lash out at politicians, judges, scientists, teachers, Wall Street, universities, the media, legislatures, even at elections. They are not interested in contemplating serious reforms to the system. They are either too pessimistic or too disappointed to believe that that is possible. So the best they can do is adopt a position of total irreverence to show they hate the players and the game. Understood in those terms, the idea that Trumpism is populist seems misplaced. Populism is a belief in the right of ordinary people, rather than political insiders, to rule. Trumpism, by contrast, operates on the presumption that ordinary people aren't going to get any chance to rule, no matter what they do. So they might as well piss off the political insiders using the only tool left available to them, the vote. While many commentators say Trump will have to bring back jobs or vibrancy to places like the Rust Belt if he wants to continue to have the support of people who voted for him, Thompson's account suggests otherwise. Many, if not most, Trump supporters long ago gave up on the idea that any politician, even someone like Trump, can change the direction the wind is blowing. Even if he fails to bring back the jobs, Trump can maintain loyalty in other ways. As long as he continues to offend and irritate elites, and as long as he refuses to play by certain rules of decorum, heaven forfend the president-elect say ill-conceived things on Twitter, Trump will still command loyalty. It's the ethic, not the policy, that matters most. Even the racism that was on full display in Trump's campaign should be understood at least in part in retaliatory terms, as directed at the political elite rather than at struggling minority groups. The Hells Angels, Thompson wrote, did things like get tattoos of swastikas, mostly because it visibly scared the members of polite society. The Angels were perfectly happy to hang out in bars with men of different races, especially if those men drove motorcycles, and several insisted to Thompson that the racism was only for show. While I have no doubt, and no one should have any doubt, that there are genuine racists in Trump's constituency, and the gleeful performance of racism is nothing to shrug off, Thompson suggests we should consider the ways in which racism might not be the core disease of Trumpism, but a symptom of a deeper illness. Thompson would also direct our attention in the early days of the Trump administration to the armed forces and the policies that will mandate what they do. For one great exception to the Angels' ethos of total retaliation against authority was the military, just as one great exception to the Trump voters' ethos of total irreverence is the police. Thompson explains that such institutions, which are premised on brute force rather than the more refined rules of intellectual engagement, maintain both a practical and cultural connection to people like the Angels. The military and the police draw mostly from poor and working-class communities to fill their ranks, and their use of violence is something the motorcycle guys understand. It is one aspect of American life they can easily imagine themselves being a part of. For his part, Thompson thought that what might prove most dangerous about the ethic of total retaliation was the way it encouraged the distrust of all authority, except for the authority of brute force. The president-elect's enthusiasm for waterboarding and other forms of torture, his hawkish cabinet choices, and his overtures to strongmen like Vladimir Putin are grave omens. We could end up back where Thompson left off at the end of his book, The Angels Marching with the John Birch Society on behalf of the Vietnam War. At the end of Hell's Angels, having spent months with the motorcycle guys, Thompson finally gets stomped by them. For some offense he doesn't understand and which he probably didn't commit, Thompson gets punched, bloodied, kicked in the face and in the ribs, spat at, and pissed on. He limps off to a hospital in the dead of night, alone and afraid. Only in that moment does Thompson realize that as a journalist, and therefore a member of the elite, he could not possibly be a true friend of the angels. Wear leather and ride a motorcycle, though he might, Thompson stood on the side of intellectual and cultural authority. And that finally made him, despite his months of good timing with the angels, subject to their retaliatory impulses. The ethic of retaliation is total. Thompson comes to realize there is nothing partial about it. It ends with violence. There's no doubt about it. Trouble lies ahead. That Hell's Angels foresaw all this 50 years ago underscores the depth and seriousness of Thompson as a political thinker and of ours as a singularly dangerous time. Trumpism is about something far more serious than Trump, something that has been brewing and building for generations. Let us take Thompson's cautions seriously, then, so that this time we Berkeley types are not naive about what we face. Otherwise, we are all liable to get stomped. So, a few of the things that jumped out at me in that article. So, to start with, the people that in the article and in the original Nation article and in the book and then this retrospective Nation article that Thompson calls the angels, the Hell's Angels, I'm not going to call them that because, from my perspective, the Hell's Angels, and particularly, I know most of them aren't Hell's Angels, but particularly people who identify with Harley-Davidson motorcycles and ride Harley-Davidson motorcycles, these are not, people suffering from economic desperation, at least not in my experience. You know, I live in rural Vermont. It is very scenic. It is very beautiful. Lots of people from out of state come here just to basically tool around on our country highways and take in the beauty. A lot of them come on motorcycles. And when I hear the words Harley-Davidson, I don't think of the, you know, live fast, die young, hard-drinking, hard-living, down-and-out losers from a mainstream perspective that Thompson was describing. The people I see on Harley-Davidson motorcycles, which are ridiculously expensive, they tend to be fairly well-off boomers, at least the ones that I see on the roads. You know, when I was in high school in the 80s, the party kids who rode motorcycles, the ones who were definitely not college-bound, they rode what we called crotch rockets. They rode Japanese superbikes. This was in Kansas City, Missouri, in the mid to late 80s. Even by that time, the Harley was considered, you know, something that old people rode, old people with money. Now, I would be the first to admit that I have absolutely no experience whatsoever with proper motorcycle gangs. So maybe there is a subculture who, you know, through drug dealing or whatever, has a lot of money to spend and they can afford to buy and maintain Harley-Davidson motorcycles. But I maintain those are not the motorcycles of the desperate class, the ones giving the middle finger to polite society. So Susan McWilliams summarizes what Thompson means when he talks about the angels. She writes, "But though Thompson's description of an alienated, white, masculine, working-class culture, one that is fundamentally misunderstood by intellectuals, is not the only one out there. It was the first. And in some ways, it is still the best psychological study of those Americans often dismissed as white trash or deplorables." So while I'm not endorsing the slur, I will refer to this class of people as deplorables. And the first thing that I think of when I think back on this article is that the deplorables, they equate competence with membership in the elite. So they love Donald Trump for running an incompetent campaign, incompetent from the perspective of political professionals, which is to say, elite insiders whose economic and material and social interests are not aligned with those of the deplorables. So I remember back in 2016, every time Trump would do something outrageous, every time he would say something which for a competent politician would be a death knell for the campaign, the corporate media and its hangers-on like NPR constantly said, "Oh, this is it for Trump. He's finally, you know, he's gone too far this time. He's over." And the deplorables, they heard that and, it tickled them. They loved to hear that. That just made them all the more enthusiastic for their guy. The other thing that comes to mind when I think back on this, just in very broad terms without looking at my notes or anything, is that the deplorables who supported Trump, and let me reiterate something that Doug Lane said on this podcast a few weeks ago. Most people who voted for Trump are just your run-of-the-mill Republicans. I mean, Trump was the only Republican option on the ballot in the general election. They weren't going to vote for Hillary Clinton, most of them. So, you know, their behavior doesn't require any special explanation. Most of the people voting for Trump didn't have any particular motivation for doing so other than the fact that they always voted Republican. So the people that we really have to focus in on, you know, if we want to do anything other than just tell ourselves comforting stories which reaffirm our pre-existing beliefs, we need to look at the people who voted for Obama twice and then turned around and voted for Trump. And when I think back on this article, one of the things that leaps out at me is that the Trump voters don't imagine for a second that Trump is really going to change anything in their favor. The forces giving shape to society, the ascendancy of finance and technology, and the resulting hollowing out of the middle class and the growing wealth divide, it is not within Trump's power to change this. The value of Trump is that the liberal elites, particularly the coastal liberal elites, hate him. And I can imagine that back in 2008, somebody who would in 2016 vote for Donald Trump, you know, they had to choose between John McCain and Barack Obama. And Barack Obama definitely seemed like something out of the ordinary, something other than business as usual. Whereas John McCain, you know, is a very establishment politician. He's been in the Senate forever. He is in no way, I mean, you could say he's got conservative credentials, but they are conservative credentials. They are not deplorable conservative credentials. So there is nothing about John McCain that would bring the deplorables out to vote. And in 2008, you know, those deplorables might have voted for Barack Obama because he was promising change. He delivered absolutely nothing of the sort, but he did hold out the hope for change. Hope being, you know, the full encapsulation of his campaign strategy. It was just a cynically pimping hope, but we didn't know that it was cynical pimping at the time. There were good reasons to think so, you know, particularly in hindsight, but I remember being, you know, caught up and hope. I didn't vote for him. I was not registered to vote in Maryland, which is where I was living when he was elected. But I remember being happy that he won, and I remember hoping and half expecting that something would get better. You know, I also held on to a cynical detachment and very, very low expectations, and my low expectations were, well, I guess just about right. But those low expectations were something that I deliberately adopted in order to temper the enthusiasm, which was infectious at the time. In 2012, Obama was the reigning champ and defender against the challenger, Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney, hedge fund guy, very respectable, suit and tie, too good looking, just respectable from every angle. The only thing that was weird about him was he's a Mormon, but you know, Mormons tend to be extremely practical and businesslike, at least in my experience of them. So again, not somebody to really, you know, for the deplorables to rally around. A very, very much an establishment sort of character, somebody who is very competent in the negative sense as far as the deplorables are concerned. So somebody votes for this hypothetical deplorable, falls for the hope rhetoric in 2008, votes for Obama, maybe is still hoping for some change in 2012, votes for Obama again, or at least doesn't turn out and vote for the Republican. And then after 8 years of those broken promises, they're more pissed off than ever. Along comes Donald Trump. I forget who said it, but some political commentator said that the people that he was talking to told him, look, Trump was not our candidate. He was our murder weapon. He was not somebody that we thought would institute wise policy and reverse course and basically make the world better. He was our way of saying, fuck you, to the people who are still doing well and the people who have social capital, social status in this world. And one group of people who have automatic social capital and social status, as the article mentioned, are scientists. And so scientific competence also marks one as either an elite or, in the case of right-wing globalist paranoia fantasies, servants of a global cabal of elites, be they Jews or reptilian overlords or just your garden variety globalist banker pedophiles, a la Alex Jones. Scientists, though, in this narrative are servants of the elites, and they are liars. They're orchestrating an ongoing campaign of lies to convince us of the reality of climate change. And the purpose for this climate change hoax is basically just to steal resources from working people, steal resources from people, put limitations on people who create jobs with living wages in manufacturing, you know, for people who don't have advanced degrees in computer science and engineering. The scientists are the stooges for these evil masterminds. Now, the idea that there are evil masterminds who are deliberately bringing about the more painful aspects of, you know, life in globalized 21st century capitalism, that's just, you know, it's a human foible. It's much easier to visualize and to imagine conscious, deliberate malevolence than it is to imagine that people who are basically good-natured and who don't deliberately wish harm on the people that they ultimately do harm are driven by the pressures of the system in which they work to enact policies that produce short-term and long-term gain for them and for their class, but which do so at the expense of the vast majority of people. That's a more difficult narrative to describe. It is one that is more difficult to imagine, and it's just not very satisfying. It's much more satisfying to envision evil people in the world deliberately doing evil for the sheer joy of the harm that they can cause. That penchant is not exclusive to the right, and it's certainly not exclusive to the deplorables. But the right-wing mainstream has been flirting with the right-wing paranoid fringe for several years now. And so paranoid globalist fantasies are much closer to the right-wing mainstream than they are on the left. Now, the other thing that jumps out for me is that deplorable voters, they want to give the middle finger to institutions. And polling data that I looked at recently showed that trust in institutions is at an all-time low in the United States. But there are two exceptions to that. They have ongoing and continued respect for the police and for the military. And one reason for that is that both the police and the military largely are made up of working class and poor people. You know, when I lived in Arkansas and Tennessee, I knew lots of people who were in the military. Didn't know them well, but I saw them. Particularly, you know, if I'd go into town, I'd go to Walmart, I would see people in uniform walking around. When I lived in New York City, I never met a single soldier. I never met anybody at a party who told me that their son or daughter or brother or sister was stationed in Iraq or Afghanistan. I didn't know anybody who had anybody who was at risk of dying in some foreign adventure in the U.S. military. If you live in the South, that certainly won't be the case. You know, they might not be close to you. They might not be in your social class, but you will know people who have been deployed or who have children who have been deployed overseas and who are, in fact, in danger of either dying or coming back in pieces. Alive, but in pieces. And as the author of the piece that I read to you wrote, Thompson would also direct our attention in the early days of the Trump administration to the armed forces and the policies that will mandate what they do. For one great exception to the angels' ethos of total retaliation against authority was the military. Just as the one great exception to Trump's voters' ethos of total irreverence is the police. Thompson explains that such institutions, which are premised on brute force rather than the more refined rules of intellectual engagement, maintain both a practical and cultural connection to people like the angels, or in our case now, the deplorables. The military and the police draw mostly from poor and working class communities to fill their ranks, and their use of violence is something the motorcycle guys understand. It is one aspect of American life they can easily imagine themselves being a part of. Now, something else Susan McWilliams wrote in this piece is that we absolutely should not be blasé or dismissive about the exaggerated and enthusiastic racial dog whistling that was part of the Trump campaign or of, you know, overt statements of racist dogma. And yet, just like the kids on 4chan were, you know, posting about their opposition to race mixing with tongue securely lodged in cheek, Hunter S. Thompson reported that, you know, in his time with the Hell's Angels, that there was a lot of racist talk, but that a lot of it was for show. And these days, it's not football season right now, so it's not a big topic this moment, but black NFL players, some of them, are kneeling during the national anthem, as you well know, in order to protest police violence against black people, police violence which is disproportionately addressed to black people. And a lot of people are very upset at this, and Trump has been playing to it. he's been calling for the firing of the players who do this, and they've been and has been calling it, you know, disrespecting of the flag and of the country. Well, the folks who are obsessively focused on identity politics say that this is just racism. This is just an overt expression of American racism, you know, this out of proportion reaction to a quiet protest, which is in no way disrespectful. I mean, taking a knee in front of the flag instead of standing there with your hand on your heart is hardly like, you know, dropping trow or giving the middle finger to the flag. But whereas some motivated ideologues would insist that we see this in no terms other than, you know, white racism, I think what a lot of people who get angry at this are sensitive to is that they see it as an attack on the institution of the police, an institution for which they have great respect. You know, even around here, there are a lot of white kids. I mean, they're in their 20s mostly, but I'll call them kids because I'm 50. A lot of white kids have been to jail. I have a new next door neighbor who's out on parole. The kids around here, I imagine, are mostly apolitical. And if they were to vote, I wouldn't be surprised if they largely voted Democrat because this is Vermont. It is New England. But there are Trump supporters around here. But my point is, I never hear any anti-police sentiment from the people who have the most involvement with the police, from the people who are the ones getting arrested, spending time in jail. You know, I had to go answer the door to the building the other day because something called an FSU, a field supervisory unit, had showed up to give my new next door neighbor a surprise urinalysis and breathalyzer test. I've never heard him complain about the police. I mean, I don't talk to him a lot, but, you know, in casual conversation, the people that I'm likely to hear expressing anger toward the police tend to be well-off liberals who are very unlikely to be on the receiving end of police violence. Now, being low on funds and perpetually so for many years now, I have been driving a very old pickup truck, which is, it just screams poverty, and that is a magnet for the police. So I personally have had encounters with the police which have left me very, very angry. And I have a long-standing, deep-seated anger at the institution of the police. And I won't deny it, and I won't try to put any sort of whipped cream on it. I think the police, as an institution, do more harm than good. Their ranks are largely filled with people from the deplorable class. And so for the deplorables, the military and the police are two potential ladders out of the life of being the designated loser. You know, police and prison guards and the criminals and prisoners that they police are basically drawn from the same pool. And both sides seem to know it. There isn't a lot of animosity, at least not that I can detect, between the two sides. So where coastal liberals see racism, I see anger at disrespecting the institution of the police. While not denying that, there's certainly plenty of racist sentiment I have encountered in the South and, seemingly surprisingly, in New York City. Not among my artist, Burning Man, tech sector set of friends, but more among people who, you know, could be my relatives. Most of my father's side of the family, which is the side from New York, have died off. But some of the most hateful, racist talk I've ever heard, you know, in person came from my Irish immigrant relatives in New York City. But that's no huge mystery, and it's not anything we need to get into. I mean, the Irish are newly white, and particularly back in my father's day and my grandfather's day, were eager to establish themselves as not being part of the racial underclass anymore. And think about this. You know what a paddy wagon is? That's the big police vehicle that they used to haul prisoners away. It got its name because so many police officers in New Jersey and New York were Irish immigrants or the children of Irish immigrants. Again, it is the poor and working class who make up the ranks of the police and the military. And the deplorables know this. That's why they don't hate the police like I do. In the comment section that grew up behind this article on the Friends of the Sea Realm, Dylan posted this quote from the movie Fight Club, a movie that I really enjoy. Somebody recently said that it hasn't aged well since 9/11 because, you know, it ends with the deliberate demolition of high-rise buildings. I watched it just recently for the first time in years with my soon-to-be 14-year-old son. And I I loved it. I think compared to a lot of things from the 90s, it really stands out as something of lasting value. So these are words that Tyler says in the basement of the bar where the original Fight Club was held. So he is talking to the people who have come to fight. You know, they started each fight session with basically a little sermon from Tyler. And in this one, he said,
"Man, I see in Fight Club the strongest and smartest men who've ever lived. I see all this potential, and I see it squandered. God damn it, an entire generation pumping gas, waiting tables, slaves with white collars. Advertising has us chasing cars and clothes, working jobs we hate so we can buy shit we don't need. We're the middle children of history, man. No purpose or place. We have no great war, no great depression. Our great war is a spiritual war. Our great depression is our lives. We've all been raised on television to believe that one day we'd all be millionaires and movie gods and rock stars, but we won't. We're slowly learning that fact. And we're very, very pissed off."
Fight Club is very much a product of the 90s. You know, it was written in the early to mid-90s, made into a film and released in 1999. And, you know, that was the dot-com boom, the long-term trends which have brought us to where we are now in terms of offshoring of labor, of the collapse of the middle class, collapse of the ability of a single non-college-educated wage earner to support a family. All of that was still in the fairly early stages, and particularly if you were focused on the stock market and the internet and tech trends and things like that, it could seem like the good times were, you know, destined to go on forever, that the long boom was inevitable. But, you know, back then, there were people who were grinding their teeth in envy and resentment watching young smart Alex get rich working for tech companies. But we weren't where we are now in terms of the disintegration of the ability of regular people to earn what used to be considered normal middle-class livelihoods. Things were still going well, at least on paper. But even when things were going well, the roles that young men were offered were unsatisfying. A life spent waiting tables or, you know, even doing better paid corporate work, like the narrator in the story who worked for an automobile manufacturer and basically went around collecting data on fatal crashes, doing the math, deciding if it would cost more to pay damages in court to everybody killed by a particular defect than it would to do a recall of the defective vehicle. That's a pretty well-paid position, and in fact, you know, he had a high-rise condo, and he had all the money he needed to fill it with clothing and furniture and furnishings from IKEA, and, you know, his struggle was a struggle to identify himself via his purchases, which was so unsatisfying to him that he had to create a sub-personality which would go off on and act on his behalf to sabotage that life without his conscious knowledge. So unsatisfying was it. So even before it was obvious that things were going south economically for much of the country, when things were going well, it was still supremely unsatisfying. And also, I'm speaking mostly from my own experience in terms of, you know, how my perceptions of the country have changed, because I spent the 90s either in college, part of it in Japan, and thereafter, you know, working in the tech sector in Seattle, and for the last couple of years of the decade, basically not having to work because I had a bunch of money. But Thompson's description of the mentality of the Hell's Angels and how applicable it is today, I think demonstrates that the trends which are now definitely, you know, have broken the surface and are impossible to ignore, that these are the current manifestation. I don't even want to say the culmination, because I don't think we've reached the culmination, but they are the current manifestation of trends which have been operating basically my entire life. I was born in 1968. And as Sue McWilliams points out in the piece in The Nation, the Hell's Angels started out as a World War II veterans group. Now, I have spent a fair amount of time and effort basically criticizing the treatment that the deplorables receive from the people who thus far remain on the winning side of the growing divide, and who don't want to talk about economic injustice and who are much more anxious to talk about race and gender. But as I've mentioned here before, while at least in Arkansas, I can move through the population of deplorables and not say anything to overtly trigger, you know, an allergic reaction from them, an allergic class-based reaction from them. I'm from those people. I'm not of those people. And I'm certainly not of the Northeastern New England variety of the deplorables. And I have no doubt that, were I to be hanging out with them exclusively, that soon I would join Hunter S. Thompson in getting my ass beat by them. Because just my vocal mannerisms would identify me as an outsider to their ranks. So while I'm irritated with people who think it's racist to talk about anything other than race or gender, I'm also in an odd position in that I'm very much of that tribe in terms of my, you know, my education, my interests, and most noticeably, I think, to the people that I encounter in real life, the way I speak. So a friend of the Sea Realm, who always posts good stuff and who is similarly very much an odd man out, is Mark Cryer. And I say his first and last name because, well, this is The Vault, and also because he posts under that name. These are things that he posts publicly under his own name, both first and last. And as I understand it, Mark is a lawyer, but one who isn't making a lot of money. He lives in rural Maine. The people around him are very much of the deplorable class. And yet he himself is a Muslim, and I think it's because he converted after marrying a Muslim woman. I'm reading between the lines a little bit there. I don't think he's stated that explicitly, but that's what I've put together from the various things that he's posted onto the Friends of the Sea Realm. But in this instance, in response to the Nation article about Hunter S. Thompson, Mark starts out by quoting part of the article, quote, "Just as there was no rational way to defend Harleys against foreign-made choppers, the Angels saw no rational grounds on which to defend their own skills or loyalties against the emerging New World Order of the late 20th century." Close quote. And Mark continues, "The way I read statements like this is that we need to bring people back into the program and always, no matter how much we dislike a group, allow them a way to save face and come back in. Always. Not sure this is likely on the left or the right these days." So yes, you definitely have to allow the demonized group to rejoin your society and do so in a way and do so on terms other than as, you know, the supplicant loser. Mark continues, "I find that the mainstream left is pretty similar to this description themselves. They operate from a mythic experience in which their identity is intractably enmeshed in their political and social life, such that rational discourse about anything that touches on these subjects is impossible. You are with us, or you are against us." And he links to an article on The New Atlantis called "Wokeness and Myth on Campus." And the picture is of students at Middlebury refusing to let Charles Murray talk. Mark continues, "I'm normally uncomfortably wedged between these groups. I usually feel more comfortable with the center-left, but I live in closer proximity to the white working class, not all of whom are right-wing. A lot of them thought they were liberals until recently and are now adrift." So I'm going to pause there because I think there are a lot of people in that position. People who consider themselves liberals and who probably voted for Democrats just as a matter of course, but who in the last few years are feeling a lot of hate directed at them from the left, largely because of their race, their being white. Mark continues, "I'm also entirely allergic to identity politics, which on the communist left is associated with the failed national liberation movements of the last century, some of the most inane experiments of the 60s and 70s New Left, and with anti-working class separatism and racism. I know lots of liberals feel their racial or gender identities are the actual core of their revolt, but I've seen plenty of separatism and don't really see much difference between the identity politics multiculturalism of the recent past and racial essentialism that most people rightly label as racist." And that brings me around to an article that I read just today. In fact, I linked to it on Twitter. So I'm going now to Twitter to find it. And while I call it up, let me just say that Follow me on Twitter if you want to. I don't put a lot of effort into maintaining my Twitter presence. As much as anything, Twitter is just a way for me to bookmark things that I have read or would like to read. But it is definitely not a medium of creative expression for me, as it is for some people. But it is easy to post something on Twitter from my phone. So the piece that I have in mind originally ran on The Intercept, but I found it via Common Dreams. And it is called Fetishizing Identity Politics Could Cost the Democrats in 2020. And don't worry, I'm not going to read this whole thing to you. Much of it is very specific to one particular Democratic race in the South that I just wasn't following at all. I don't know the players at all, but the beginning of the article is more general in its scope. So I'm going to read you just like four paragraphs. So this is from the month of June, 2018. It ran in The Intercept. The author is Brianna Gray, who writes, "It's inevitable that every election between now and 2020 will be read like tea leaves, full of potential insights into how to unseat Trump. But that analysis must be rooted in evidence, what policies candidates actually support and how they frame them, rather than forcing pre-existing ideological commitments onto ill-fitting facts. Sanders' campaign terraformed the landscape of political possibility." And let me just pause right now and say that the Democratic Party has agreed to, I don't know if they're going to completely do away with the superdelegate system, but they are going to diminish the power of the superdelegates. Because I don't know if you remember this, but I remember this vividly, that both Google and every news source during the primary, from the very first primary, counted all of Hillary Clinton's pledged superdelegates from the very outset. So before the very first primary contest, Clinton had an enormous lead on Sanders in terms of basically what all mainstream institutions were reporting, including Google. Google pissed me off even more than, you know, the likes of MSNBC in basically telling voters from the very beginning of the primary process that Hillary Clinton was the winner of that process, which still had many months to go. So anyway, to my mind, that is a step in the right direction for the Democratic Party. Continuing now from the Brianna Gray article. "Sanders' campaign terraformed the landscape of political possibility. Socialist is no longer a slur. Medicare for all is a litmus test for 2020 hopefuls, and Americans are no longer so inured to the influence of money in politics. To millions on the left, the then relatively unknown Vermont senator's unexpected surge in the 2016 Democratic primary and consistently strong approval ratings demonstrate that electoral victory in 2020 requires adopting much of his platform and approach to politics. This means, among other things, making economic inequality central to any prospective presidential agenda. Yet the very concept of economic anxiety has become a punchline at best, and a third rail at worst among a loud swath of the Democratic coalition, because economic concerns have, at times, been used as a pretext to avoid recognizing the role racism and xenophobia played in Donald Trump's popularity. Many Democrats now bristle at the notion that the Democratic Party should reach out to working-class whites at all. Understandably fearful that, quote-unquote, wooing white voters might require an appeal to bigotry, it's now commonly argued that the Democratic Party should concentrate its efforts on non-voters of color instead. The divide between Team Economic Justice and Team Demographic Destiny now informs how different factions of the left, broadly defined, decipher the results of Democratic primaries and special election battles. And unfortunately, this has led to dangerously inaccurate and biased prescriptions for 2020. Non-white and/or female candidates are praised for advancing identity politics if they win, regardless of how they campaigned. And efforts to include white voters in one's coalition are blamed for faltering campaigns, regardless of a candidate's more substantive failures. If all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And with a belief that demographics hold the key to unlocking a Democratic victory, Democrats stand poised to ignore the most important lesson of 2016. People turn out for material change." That is something I was pointing to much earlier in the podcast when I was talking about how some people who in 2016 voted for Trump voted for Obama in the two previous elections because they were hoping for a material improvement in their own circumstances. And because Barack Obama was seemingly different from previous politicians, you know, they rolled the dice on him. And from here on out, the article gets very specific about the gubernatorial primary in Georgia. So I'll stop there. And most of the article is not to be found here on Common Dreams, but over on The Intercept. So what I found just really notable about the bit that I just read was the idea that there is a faction within the Democratic Party who is explicitly allergic and averse to trying to get white people to vote for Democrats, that they would much rather have their victory hinge on whether or not they can get people who traditionally haven't been reliable voters out to the polling stations on Election Day. Undeniably fearful that wooing white voters might require an appeal to bigotry, it's now commonly argued that the Democratic Party should concentrate its efforts on non-voters of color instead. It seems not only just counterproductive and, you know, a poor strategy, but just surreal to me that anybody within the Democratic Party would think that their only legitimate path to victory would be to get people who traditionally don't vote in high numbers out to the polls on Election Day, and that trying to appeal to the material interests of people who do vote is off the table. That just seems nuts. You know, being who I am and where I am, both in terms of my education, my demographics, my skin tone, my gender, but also, you know, the economic class of my parents, who were first generation middle classers, basically, both just slightly older than the oldest baby boomers. My father's parents, my father's mother, came to the United States from Ireland by herself at the age of 16. And his father, you know, worked physically demanding industrial jobs his whole life. They were definitely, you know, low status Irish working class. And my mother's family, also Irish, but has been in the United States a lot longer, you know, were farmers in Arkansas. My mother's mother, I think she had a third grade education, and my grandfather, her husband, may have gotten into high school, but he didn't finish high school. And they put all four of their children through college. To them, it was very important to secure for their children the sorts of opportunities that they never had. So, you know, their children means my mother. So while my mother and father were middle class, at least, you know, in their income and in their lifestyle, they didn't come from middle class roots. And, you know, I was raised with their middle class values, but have now, in terms of my, you know, material station in life, fallen well below the middle class. And so some of the deplorables around me are doing much better financially than I am. And yet it seems like the world that is emerging is more my world than it is theirs. Not so much because of my, you know, middle class sensibilities, but I think because of my artistic, creative, performance-oriented sensibilities. That very few jobs are safe in the era of, you know, rapid technological advancement and automation, but that presenters, artists, and synthesizers of information and presenters of that synthesis will be among the last to be automated out of existence. This is something I've been trying to impress upon my youngest son who's visiting with me now. I know this is, you know, really rolling the stone uphill, but I've been trying to get him to work through tutorials for things like ZBrush or, you know, After Effects character animation. I would love to get either of my two children to a point where, you know, they could help me in my media production efforts for money. But it's really very difficult to pry them away from the video games. My son made a token, like, 20-minute effort to follow along in a tutorial for ZBrush, which is a 3D sculpting-based program. And like I said, he didn't stick with it. And I'm pretty sure that I'm entirely successful in not preaching to them. But I do try to impress upon them subtly but consistently that this is a tough time for a young man to be trying to establish himself as an independent economic entity. And, you know, if you're going to try to do it without a college education, it's going to take some self-directed effort to not fall into the lowest common denominator of service industry jobs, which are soul-crushing. But the allure of the screen is strong. And I know that when I was in high school, I had absolutely no ear whatsoever for any sort of advice along those lines. You know, advice about what I could do to get a better start on my career. I was just interested in partying with my friends and, you know, reading books and drawing and exploring esoteric topics, but I was in no way interested in anything at all practical. And my kids are no different. So getting back to the topic of Democrats hoping to grab the White House back from the Republicans and most especially from the detested personality of Donald Trump. The two things that I think they really need to do, one, are appeal to the material interests of people who are feeling insecure. Many of those people are white. And, you know, they are going to have to appeal to the material interests of white people, not necessarily as white people, but you cannot win national elections by denigrating white people. That's just not going to happen. It's not going to work. So they have to appeal to the material self-interests of the class of people who are feeling stressed economically, who don't feel like they are participants, who get really angry, like I get angry when I turn on the radio and I hear, say, on, you know, Marketplace, that the economy is going gangbusters right now. For whom? For whom is it going gangbusters? Not for working people. Times are tough for a lot of people. And, you know, and a lot of those people are white. And to say that you can't ever say that, or you can't appeal to the needs, the genuine, legitimate needs that those people have, because it would be racist, is absurd. And it is a total losing strategy. So the Democrats have to be willing to appeal to material interests in the way that got white voters to vote for Barack Obama in 2008. And this, I know, is absolutely impossible. They have to stop reacting with outrage and righteous indignation every time Donald Trump provokes them with a crass statement or an absurd tweet or with, you know, an obvious untruth, with a clear and bald-faced lie. He does this 10 times a day, and it just astounds me that there's a certain class of people who never tire of expressing their outrage at his antics. This delights the deplorables. This makes the deplorables love Donald Trump. If you focus on the material interests of the people who are not doing well in this economy and do so sincerely, I think there are a fair number of people who voted for Trump and who like him, who, when forced to look at him through that lens, will realize that he's not their friend and not doing them any benefit. But as long as he is the clown who provokes the liberals and makes them foam at the mouth, well, that's when he's winning. That's when Donald Trump is in his place of strength and competence, the sort of competence that the deplorables can respect and get behind. So this is as close to mainstream political partisan politics as I like to get. I think I haven't read this book yet, so I can't promise that I'll be ready to do a podcast on the topic in less than a week. But there is a book, and I'm not even going to look up the title right now. I'll just tell you what it's about. It is by a guitarist from Blondie, and he has a decades-long interest in the occult, and he's written a book about the right-wing manifestations of occult thinking, and it didn't start with Keck on 4chan. You know, I hate to go straight to the Nazis, but Hitler and members of his inner circle were devout occultists. There is a long history of occult activity in the service of a right-wing political and social agenda. And that's what this book is about. So I hope to get that read. And if not that particular book, then I hope to at least do enough research on this topic in general to hold your interest for an hour as I report to you what I have learned. It is a topic that fascinates me. All right, I shall leave off for now. Thanks for listening. Thank you for subscribing. And I will talk to you again soon.